Welcome to this special edition of Radioactive Magazine. This is Bill Claus. I'm going to start off with a little bit of the story of my life, not because it's unique, but because it applies to so many millions of other people of my same generation. I'm a certified member of the Baby Boom Generation, born in 1948 in a Midland-sized town of Marshall, Missouri. And the world I was born into is vastly different than the one that we live in today. I remember as a small boy, we chose up teams by Eeny, meeny, miny, moe, catch a tiger by the toe. Of course, we didn't say tiger. You know what we said. And those real hard nuts that you can't hardly crack, the ones with the dark shells that I learned later in life are called Brazil nuts, we called them tiger toes. And, of course, everybody smoked in the 50s. Like I said, a very different world. And when we got tired of chomping on our candy cigarettes, we'd steal a couple of cigarettes from our parents and we'd pass them around, but you had to make sure that you didn't tiger lip the cigarettes. And if a new kid came around that had curly hair or maybe a little bit of a darker skin, we would always make fun of him that there must have been a tiger in the woodpile. Looking back, of course, such language is absolutely appalling, but I don't know, we didn't look at it that way. We were just kids and it was the world we were given, not the one we chose. Probably the most heartbreaking thing for me is that my own parents, who I loved dearly and who, as a general rule, were just easy to get along with, they were personable, they were friendly, they were generous, they were kind, used the word tiger their entire lives. Was I a racist? Well, probably by definition I was, but certainly not by choice. It's the world I was given, not the one I chose. But the truth of the matter was, I gave black people not much thought at all because I didn't know any of them. I never met any of them. I didn't have any more opinion of them than I did an Eskimo or the Polynesians. After all, we lived on the west side of town, and Tiger Town was on the east side of town. Later on, we moved to Tucson, Arizona, where I got my first insight when I noticed there that it was the Mexicans that were the tigers in the community. But somehow I managed to spend my entire life in school from kindergarten through graduating from college without having a single close relationship with an African-American person. And I was the first one on either side of my family to ever go to college. Went to college from 1966 to 1970, which means really was the height of the 60s. And I was a enthusiastic participant in the 60s, let's put it that way. Yes, I grew my hair long and grew a beard so I could be a nonconformist like everybody else. Of course, going to college changed my way of thinking in a lot of ways. First of all, there was the Vietnam War, which radicalized a whole generation. And probably the lot of us kind of chose up sides and each trying to be as more radical than the other, where we read Marx and we read Bakunin and we read Kropotkin and as far as civil rights were concerned, we read James Baldwin, we read Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. So we, for the first time in our lives, maybe started considering what civil rights was all about. 1970, moved from Tucson, Arizona to Kansas City, Missouri, and took a job with the Social Security Administration. Now, say what you will about federal employment. It really is a good way, if you have a career there, of working with a very diverse population. And for the first time in my lives, I had lots and lots of relationships over the years with my African-American colleagues, both in the union. I walked picket lines with them. We partied hardy. We fought the good fight together on the floors, doing our job, working together, working as colleagues. Some of them managers, some of them not. And by and large, just for getting a well-rounded education, what it was to be around a diverse population. And probably the most profound thought that I got out of the whole thing is not something all that profound. Turns out, hey, they're human beings. And in my personal life, I've had African-American friends, and my daughter has, who's single now but has been serially monogamous her whole life, I've had African-American partners, and my grandson, one of his best friends, is Stefan, has been over our house 100 times, and whenever he sees me, gives me a hug and calls me Papaw. So that's a really marked change from being born into a family where you didn't ever cross the line, went to the other side of town to even see what the other side looks like. So my personal life is one way that it looks like the world that I've directly experienced it has really changed immensely. A lot of other ways, for example, is almost the total abolishment of the N-word among white people, which I think is a great thing. Just for those African-Americans that may be wondering, when a group of white people get around, we don't sit around and use the N-word. I don't remember the last time I even heard a white person use the N-word, and I think rightfully so. Culturally, you know, I was born into a world that had Stephen Fetchett, Rochester, and Amos and Andy, and now we have a world with Oprah, Prince, Denzel Washington. You can go down the list yourself. The world I was born into, there was no such thing as black elected officials. And, of course, now we've got black mayors, we've got black governors, we've got black senators, and, of course, we have Barack Obama. Hey, I was one of those white people that cried when he was elected. So, yes, in many ways, just from my direct personal experience, it seems like things have vastly improved on the race front. But when you get to it and look at it very closely and you look at it from a critical point of view, what you see is it's about a mile wide but only about an inch deep. And what you have to do is drill down through that inch to find where the systemic racism that is so hard to uproot comes from and what really is what we have to fight against. There's lots of systemic racism when you stop and think about it. For example, redlining never went away. I mean, it may have happened that they were redlined east of Truce years ago, but you go east of Truce now and it's effectively redlined, whether it is technically or not. Or the thousands of black youth that they put in jail during the crack cocaine epidemic, whereas now everybody's hair on fire to come up with money to have treatment centers for the opioid and heroin crisis that they have in the suburbs. One thing we shouldn't forget is how closely aligned race and class are. Now, when I'm talking about class, I am not talking about sophistication or character. I'm talking about socioeconomic class. So the fight for 15 is a fight for Black Lives Matter, and the fight for universal health care is a fight for Black Lives Matter. That's also systemic racism we need to get past. And while white privilege is a very real part of our culture, keep in mind that it's not evenly distributed. If you're an unemployed coal miner or auto worker that's got laid off because of automation, you don't feel particularly privileged. And sometimes, but not always, white privilege is simply a matter of being treated fairly and with respect. Our goal, after all, is not to start shooting white people because they have a broken taillight, but to stop shooting black people because of it. And finally, what makes it so difficult for white people to walk in the same shoes of black people is it's just not part of our experience. We don't go to the store and get followed around because people think we're going to steal something. We're not pulled over for driving while white. We're not subjected to some yahoo driving by and yelling racial slurs at us. Okay, that's enough of me. Let's go on to the show here. Coming up, we have activists from the Metropolitan Organization for Racial and Economic Equality, also called More Square. We got Katina Taylor, who's going to give us a little bit of information about Say Her Name and remind us that black women matter, too. Keith Washington is going to interview somebody that's a stone-cold racist. Devin Burkhart from the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights is going to talk about the Boogaloo Boys and their attempt to start a second civil war. And then information from the Showing Up for Racial Justice organization. And finally, my favorite segment of the thing is a good friend, a actor, a songwriter, a recording artist, and just an all-around good guy, Danny Cox, is going to talk about his adventures of riding around in the South in the 1960s of driving while black. All right, first off, though, here we go. Here's something the whites don't have to contend with. That is the offense of moving furniture while black.
Well, as you know, I was moving into my place, and actually I had been moving in for about a month or so. I had bought the place, and I had been moving some stuff in. So I had moved most of the stuff on Saturday afternoon, and then I had to come back and get the rest of it, and it was late because the people that were helping me, the movers, were running late. So that means I was running late. So by the time I got back here, it was just after midnight, and I was unloading. And I saw the cop was going back and forth patrolling the street, but he never said anything until I had the last thing, which was the television set, of course. And then he snuck up behind me and told me to put the TV down. And so then I told him, you know, that this was my place now and everything, and he didn't want to hear that. So he put me up against the wall on the side of the house and started patting me down. And then he called for the backup and everything, and then they came in, and he put me in the handcuffs too, by the way. So I have to sit in the back of the truck while the rest of them went through the house looking for the paperwork to prove that it was my house. So then when he found the paperwork and everything, then they told him to take off the handcuffs, and I have to show him my ID and everything. Basically, essentially, that was about it. I was arrested, you know, on my own property while I was moving into my house.
So it's interesting that you you kind of talked about Morse Squared as an organization, and you know, really, right now after the killing of George Floyd, I think we all have our eye on policing. And as like the criminal justice co-chair of the Metro Organization for Racial and Economic Equity, of course that's local control of the KCPD, and policing is the focus in that task force. But one thing that really drew me to Morse Squared and kept me coming is that we have issue task forces on both sides of the state line, mind you, about different aspects of like basically how systemic racism affects people's lives. Of course, in the criminal justice side, I think we're all, especially through Black Lives Matter, that's being given into sharp focus. But education is another very popular and very dedicated task force. And I think that's something that, they've been defunding education using TIF and tax abatements for years. That's not an issue that I'm part of personally, but systemic racism hits people in the real estate. It fits Black business owners, something that we have a workforce development task force and about giving equal opportunities to Black business owners, and that people, diverse people are on projects such as the airport, for example. So it's to me, it's like the roots of white supremacy touch so many different systems. Redlining, which affects education, and and of course policing and incarceration. It has its finger in all of these systems. So to be an organization that says, hey, we're going to look at all of these ways that racism affects Black and brown folks, I think is important, because we have very specific issues, but they're all, white supremacy is at the root of all of them.
How many volunteers do you have with Morse Squared? Do you know offhand, or activists?
So we're a coalition of both individual members and 30 congregations of different faiths. Like, for example, I'm a Unitarian Universalist. So All Souls is one of those member congregations. So within those think about how many people are in a congregation. Like if you are a part of a member congregation, you are a member of Morse Squared, whether you're active all the time or not. We definitely have more activity around Medicaid expansion right now. Again, that's another way that racial and economic equity is so important. And of course, I'm here, because we have an 80-year-old institution, state control of the Kansas City Police Department, that is really a relic of a bygone Pendergrast era that is still hanging around. For the people that don't know, our governor appoints 4 out of 5 of the police commissioners, with our mayor being the only elected official on that board. And we really have no say on those appointees. Those appointees all typically come from the Brookside Plaza area. I think we've only had 2 in the Northland and 1 east of Truce that has been appointed. So it doesn't really represent us in a demographic kind of way. And we can't hold those people accountable. So, okay, the governor appoints them. We as Kansas Citians we're not solely responsible for the governor. If we don't like the governor, he can keep on, we can't hold him accountable like we can local officials. So that that distance, you know, makes it very difficult for us to hold any of those officials accountable. And a lot of the any changes involved in the Kansas City Police Department, they're tied up in state statutes. Former Commissioner Alvin Brooks, the former Mayor Sly James, they both said, oh, we agree with some of these changes that Moore Squared was proposing at the time. This is years ago. But we feel that because of the state statutes, we do not have the power or authority to make those changes. So even the commissioners themselves feel limited in making any sort of reform to the KCPD. So it's really, you know, a very, like I said, it's an outdated system that doesn't make sense in the community that we're currently living in. So that's where I keep my focus.
But I know that the Black Lives Movement has like eight or nine things that they wanted to, the police reforms to adopt. Do you know if any of those were adopted by our folk?
Are you ever referring to the eight can't wait?
Right.
Like the banning of the chokeholds?
I didn't even know.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that's why I wanted to be sure that we were talking about the same thing.
Yeah.
So the Board of Police Commissioners had a special meeting about that, specifically about those demands, to carefully explain why they won't do any of them, which required some pretty substantial mental gymnastics, in my opinion, to try to justify why we can't ban chokeholds. I feel, and I don't know about you, that's a no-brainer. Why are cops choking people? They have handcuffs, they have tasers, they, I'm not a criminal justice, professor, but to me that it seems like it is the lowest of low bars that they still refuse to meet. Just as one example of the eight can't wait. Some of that is simple as de-escalation and having a very clear use of force policy. None of the KCPD, because of their state control, they're not transparent at all. We don't know what their policies are. We have no way to exert influence as local people on those policies, because I feel, you know, with local control, we can revamp that citizen complaint process, but especially look at what policies they already have, and us as the people who are paying, that's the biggest line item in the city budget, that we have very little say in how they divert those funds. And again, hey, we're giving you money. Have a use of force policy. Have a this. No, we really can't. We don't have that kind of influence on our own PD.
If anything you want to add, you're welcome to.
Well, you saw my baby right here, right? I've been telling my baby that he's going to be treated different. Like, again, he's too young to understand this, but I look at him and I tell him, I said, you're going to be treated differently. People that look different from you are going to be treated differently than you. And I just kind of look at him and I think about all those moms who have lost their sons, and they're having their own event July 24th. And I'm like, you know, I can't even imagine losing my son, but I just want people to be treated the way my little white boy is going to be treated when he interacts with the police officers. And that is not the reality we live in. I just want to shout out to those moms.
Well said.
Hello, this is Joseph Jackson, and I host Cowtown Conversations here at 90.1 FM KKFI. And I'm giving my story, my testimony of what it means to be African American in America and how we're actually treated differently. My first interaction with the police was when I was 16 years old, and I was at the plaza, the site of today's racial injustice. And I was, me and two other friends, we were running from the parking garage because we were trying to make the movie and I had to go to the restroom. And the security officer said, halt. And I turned around and looked at him and said, what's wrong? He's like, you're running out of the parking garage. And I'm like, okay, I didn't have any tools, didn't have anything, no bags, nothing in my hand. And I just looked at him and said, well, you can't detain us. You can only report. And then at that point in time, he picked up his radio and called for KC Police Department to come out, and I told my friends to halt, because we could go from being right to being wrong, and in today's society that means we can go from being right to being dead. And so 5 minutes later the police department came and they asked me why was I running. I said, because I'm trying to make the movie. When the movie was on the plaza and I need to go to the restroom. And their response was, well, we've had a lot of break-ins in cars and you were around the parking garage. So they then asked me and my two friends for our ID, which we gave it to them. We had no wants, no warrants. But I want to go back because the one thing, if you're African-American, usually the father in that community will have that conversation with the son. What happens when you are stopped by the police? Because it's those type of conversations that have kept many young black African-Americans from not winding up dead. And I thank my father, God rest his soul, that he had that conversation with me. So I knew the things to do and the things not to do. So we then went back down. They asked me to go down and show them my car. I did. They ran the tags on my car, which came back no wants, no warrants, registered to me. They then asked me to open up the door, and I showed them I had the ability to stick the key in, turn it, open it up. And then they were shining a light in it, looking for anything. 20 minutes later, we were still back sitting on the sidewalk. There was nothing found. And the officer just said, well, next time you just might want to be careful where you're going and where you're running at. That was a total 90 minutes worth of negative interaction with the police department, and I had did nothing wrong. So what's been going on around here in Kansas City has been going on systematically since the turn of dawn of time. But unless we as a community, that's both black voices and white voices, Latino voices, American voices, speak up, this will continue to happen. And I know right now we're saying that black lives matter. We're not saying that any other lives don't matter. What we're saying that right now is that black lives are endangered and we are at risk every time we go out of our house, because one negative interaction with the police department can lead to our death. And you look at Michael Brown in St. Louis, you know, the thing with George Floyd, you know, the young man who was playing with an airsoft gun in Cleveland, the officer rolled up, automatically went to shoot. But if you look at what happens in other communities, you know, we've had a standoff here. Individual fire weapons at the police department, but their life wasn't taken. It's like there's a shoot first and ask questions later mentality because of the color of our skin.
My name is Katina Taylor, and I am the acting board secretary with KKFI, but I'm also a native Kansas Cityan and a very involved and engaged community member. I live in the Blue Hills neighborhood, where I also sit on the board of the Neighborhood Association. Today, I wanted to give some information about the Say Her Name campaign. The Say Her Name campaign was actually launched by Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw and the African American Policy Forum in 2014. What we came to find, or what they came to find at that time, is that as we talked about the intersectionality as it relates to police violence and police brutality, is that the names of African American men were being lifted up, the recordings of police acting violently against African-American men were being publicized, and they were being shown in the media in record numbers. But at the same time, for every one well-noted instance of police brutality against black men, there were at least two stories of assaulted, raped, or black women being killed or girls being victimized by racist police violence. And those names weren't being shared in the media. Those stories weren't being told or shared in the media. And so Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw and the African American Policy Forum, as well as citizens like myself, African American women, felt that it was imperative to begin lifting those names up, getting this information out in the community so that we can have a real conversation about all lives matter as it relates to the Black Lives Matter campaign. And so if we can't and we don't have those conversations, are we really saying that all Black lives matter or that all lives matter? Women can't be kept out of the conversation. And it's really scary and shameful that Black women and girls as young as 7 and as old as 93 have been killed or victimized by the police, though we rarely hear their names. So knowing their names is a necessary, and it's a sufficient condition to change or clear up the view of the wide-ranging circumstances that make this whole issue important. And so we have to understand that Black women's bodies disproportionately are subjected to police violence, and to tell their stories to support their families and to find justice for these girls and these women, we have to say their name. So that's kind of where we are with the movement. Every year there's a big vigil in memory of Black women and girls who have been killed by the police. We certainly can't leave out our trans women in this conversation who also go underreported as it relates to violence against trans women across the country, but especially here in Kansas City, that we are consistently hearing these stories of these traumatizing events, and we have to shine a light on them.
And, you know, how has being a Black immigrant affected your life?
Thank you for having us. I'm glad to be here sharing my brother's story with you all. So I'm here mainly on behalf of my brother, Giancarlo Jimenez Joseph, who died by suicide in 2017 in detention in ICE custody. His death affected us in profound ways. Prior to his detention and his death, we were not aware of the challenges that immigrants face in detention, at least not to the level that they are. And my family decided that we were going to pursue some ways of activism so that we can do something and help it so that this doesn't happen to anyone else. And that's why I'm here today sharing a story. But essentially, my brother, who was also a Black Latino or Afro-Latino, he was, I believe, racially profiled. He was basically stopped while brown, right? He was in a car, in a vehicle, and he fell within the big percentage of people in this country who are immigrants who are brown or Black, and unfortunately, you know, they are pulled over for one reason or another, and then they end up scooped up by ICE. With Gene, I'm sure we'll talk more about this tonight, but his issue was that, or the issue that ICE had, or local enforcement had with him, was that they noticed a misdemeanor on his record, and it was strictly about his criminal record. And none of it was really immigration or an immigration violation. So that was enough for them to put a whole ICE hold on him, and ICE scooped him up. And unfortunately, my brother suffered from schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, which was made known to the immigration facility where he was held. On the day that he arrived, they have to screen detainees and screen for those things, and they were fully aware of his condition and the fact that he needed special treatment and needed not to be in a place like that, but needed to be in a medical facility instead. So with Gene is how we call my brother. He ended up in solitary confinement because that's one of the ways that they treat people with his mental condition. People that are mentally ill end up in solitary confinement away from the general population for different reasons that they, you know, they make up reasons and excuses. One of them is, you know, he's could harm others and he's at risk of harming himself. So we don't, you know, we want to make sure that we place him in a place where we could survey, we could watch him. Well, at every turn, ICE broke their policies with my brother. They did not watch him. They did not follow their own policies that they have in place where you're supposed to be watching him every 15 minutes or 30 minutes or so. My brother ended up in solitary for 19 days. On the 19th day, he took his life with a sheet, with his own bed sheet. And he unfortunately, you know, his time in there got prolonged because he did not have the legal representation that he needed at the time. He, first of all, did not even have it at the stage, the initial stages where you can get a bond, you know, your bond hearing.
This is Keith Washburn, and I searched for a couple of years to find a white supremacist who was willing to go on the air. Finally, I found a guy in 2018. Here are just 5 minutes of excerpts from a 45-minute conversation. It starts slow, but it gets better and better.
Well, tell me, go back if you can, in your history, how old were you when you first joined the movement? And I guess we also want to kind of make the distinction between what is a white supremacist group and what is a white nationalist group. Are they the same thing, or is there a slight difference?
There really is not much of a difference in it. It's basically the same thing, but we just push farther another side of it.
Okay, so you would consider yourself a white nationalist, right?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Just your general beliefs that you were taught from your parents and so forth. Do you think that you always had a prejudicial view of people of color?
Oh, yeah, people of color, of course, because I went to school with only 19 people in my senior class. That's a very small town. I grew up out in the country, in the wood, basically, not in the suburb area, not in the city. So it was all white schools and just how my upbringing was.
So you're graduating class of 19, all white people.
Yes, sir.
Okay. You know, do you think that white folks and black folks should be segregated again? Is that one of the things that you personally believe?
Well, let's see here. I think we should all be able to be separated if we want to be. I feel like right now, if you look in our society, black folks live in the wards. They live in the projects. You do have your upper class of people, but we're still segregated out here on the streets. I still think that I feel comfortable around my own or my own people versus a bunch of other races that I don't know anything about. I don't agree with their beliefs or their structures or anything like that.
Well, that brings up another question. There's been a lot of talk about people that have a Confederate flag, and this is very bothersome to most people of color, particularly African Americans. So what do you think about the Confederate flag? Does it symbolize an anti-black or an anti-African American sentiment, or do you think it's more of like being proud to be from the South or something like that? What would you say about the Confederate flag? And by the way, do you fly one?
I will always fly the Confederate flag. My tattoo work will say other things too, but the Confederate, the Civil War was not fought over slavery. There was many African Americans who fought on both sides for that. Everybody thinks the Civil War, it was not fought over slavery. It was North and South. That's all that it was. So, I mean, it's not, the Confederate's not a racial thing. It's not. The rebel flag's not a racist thing. It's not. It's about the Civil War. It's about our history. It's about our past.
So let me ask you, what, you may have said it and I just missed it, but what was the Civil War over?
It was the North and the South.
Was it over a way of life? What was the point? Why were they so upset with each other if it wasn't over slavery and people in the North wanting to abolish slavery?
No, yeah, it wasn't fought. It wasn't fought over slavery. It was a result of a long-standing controversy. And, you know, I mean, I can't give you the exact. Sorry, I'm kind of caught me. You kind of put me in a deer in the headlights here. From what I know, what I've read, it wasn't over slavery. You know, Abraham Lincoln released the slaves, stuff like that. But from what I know, the North is that wasn't fought over slavery. It was just differences.
Okay. What would be one of your goals for this movement?
You know, but it's the people we're against, which are the Jewish community and the liberals, the Antifa, the things trying to stop us from producing for our own race, to trying to stop us from anything, you know, and right now.
Okay. So what would be, so you didn't mention African-Americans. Are they one of the main groups that you don't like, or are they just sort of, well, it's a person of color that I just don't really want to hang around with?
Well, yeah, because, you know, their beliefs, their structures, their everything's different than we are. They all say we're all the same, but we're not. It's like the Black Lives Matter and stuff like that. Like, I, you know, out here, they don't do nothing. They just rob. They've got drugs and guns. I mean, that's something we don't do. So I believe that they're against it. They totally hate the white man, hate this. You can see that online on videos to where they're talking about killing the white man. Oh, they just things that we're not about to tell them that.
So in some ways, the anger has been escalated by the fact that there are African-Americans who seem angry, who seem to me making mm-hmm. white people as targets. Is that what you would say?
Oh, yes. You can see it on the news. That is correct, yes.
Okay.
And by us standing up for what is right for ours, we're called the racists, we're called the bigots, we're, you know, shoved on the news that we're just standing up, like everything, like the tearing down monuments. We're standing up for our future of our existence. That's what we're standing up for in this America.
Okay.
They're both against the white man is what it is, and it's all it is.
Well,
I'm not saying all African-Americans, I'm not saying all Jewish people, but I'm saying majority of it attacking us.
Okay. Do you think that your group is racist in any way or more racist than some of the other groups out there?
Well, I can't speak for everyone as a whole. I can speak for myself. No, I don't think so, because you're all going to have certain people. No, I'm sorry. What was the question again? Sorry.
My name is Devin Burkhardt. I'm with the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights. We're a national anti-bigotry organization based in Kansas City and Seattle, and we track emerging threats to civil and human rights. Most specifically, we track kind of racism, anti-Semitism, homophobia, and other forms of bigotry. You know, and in this current era, we're really experiencing a couple of different major threats. You know, on the one hand, we have the emerging threat of coronavirus. COVID-19 has agitated and mobilized the base of the far right that we haven't seen before. You know, our latest numbers show that there are around 2.7 million people active in over 1,000 groups around the country who are actively trying to circumvent and protest against efforts to try to slow the spread of the virus. So there are folks out there who are actively engaging in promoting COVID-19 conspiracy theories, all grounded in kind of racism and bigotry. They're out there promoting the idea that the whole thing is a hoax, you know, and that the more than 140,000 people now who have already died, that's all just a myth. They're out there promoting the idea that wearing a mask is somehow an affront to their freedom and opposed to, you know, any of those restrictions. So it is one of those areas where we're really concerned about the impact that that's having, you know, on public safety and, you know, the attempts to control the spread of this virus, you know, and in the middle of all that, while we've been keeping a really close eye on all of that, because that's one important thing, because that's spawned a lot of these armed protests that we saw, you know, in March and April, where folks like Michigan militia groups showed up at the state house with AR-15s and tried to storm into the legislature and demand their way to reopen the economy, you know, and thereby quickly spread the disease, you know, in a lot more places. You know, and in the midst of that, you had folks like the Boogaloo Boys. You know, for those not familiar with the term, the Boogaloo Boys are kind of a militia offshoot that is encouraging the idea that a second civil war is right around the corner, and they want to jumpstart that as quickly as possible. So they have, in a number of instances, engaged in, you know, attempts to commit horrific acts of violence. We've already seen some major arrests in those cases, you know, in places like right there in Missouri. You had an individual in the heart of the COVID-19 pandemic back in March get arrested for plotting to blow up a hospital that contained COVID-19 patients, in part because he didn't like the governor's restrictions on people's right to mingle with one another. And at the same time, he hoped that that would accelerate things and start, you know, an incoming civil war, kind of, you know, again, trying to jumpstart the idea. So while all of that's going on, then of course we had the horrific murder of George Floyd. And that changed things once again, because, you know, once again, we saw a tremendous outpouring and uprising for the movement for Black Lives and for folks out on the streets protesting for Black Lives and Black Lives Matter. That was a significant change. It changed both the national conversation around race and who and what we are as a nation in the 21st century. And it also then put those far right groups, you know, white nationalists and others, on the defensive. Suddenly they were freaked out by the changing dynamics going on the streets, where hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people were turning out in big cities and small towns and little hamlets all over the place to speak up and stand up for Black lives. And it was a really tremendous moment that forced those on the far right into a defensive crouch. And so for a number of weeks, we saw them trying to stay around the edges of these events, looking for places to engage and to create havoc. And we've seen the number of counter protests against these groups now pick up significantly. So now we've seen hundreds of far right protests at Black Lives Matter events, some of which involved violence, others of which have involved harassment and intimidation and a heavy dose of racism and bigotry. As things continue to move into a new phase, we're concerned about both the rising level of backlash to Black Lives Matter, you know, those folks who were out looking to protest, you know, and to, you know, reclaim the streets, if you will. And we're also concerned about the kind of lower level harassment and intimidation that continues, that was stirred up in these counter protests. You know, and that includes a lot of armed mobilizations by militia groups, sometimes in many places with the support of local sheriffs and law enforcement. You know, and and having unelected, unaccountable, untrained far-right paramilitaries on the streets is a new and dangerous turn for this country, particularly when they're getting the endorsement or the tacit support from law enforcement. So we're kind of trying to keep an eye on all of those things, right? We're watching what white nationalists are doing and how they're responding to, you know, Confederate statues coming down and the movement for Black Lives. We're also paying attention to what's going on with COVID-19 and how that's impacting the far right and how they're using it to draw people in, right? It's that first step on a larger conveyor belt. If someone might be concerned about, you know, reopening the economy, that might get them involved in one of these groups, at which point they're inundated with these conspiracy theories and these ideas, which draw them further down that conveyor into more dangerous and toxic ideology, And that's where I think we're at today. We have both a mass movement that is trying to mainstream this stuff through the protests against COVID-19. And those white nationalists and others on the far right are using the counter protests against Black Lives Matter to also try to reclaim the streets and make things unsafe and dangerous for people of color in particular, but for all of us, as they try to reinforce their will through the threats and the active use of violence and intimidation. We are, you know, living in interesting times, and we are going through a real challenging phase of our nation's history. It is a battle about who and what we are as a nation, and whether or not we're going to let the forces of white supremacy and white nationalism define who and what we are as a nation in an exclusive way that excludes people of color, that excludes immigrants, that excludes the LGBTQ+ community, that excludes non-Christians, that excludes so many others. Or if we're going to truly live out our ideals, you know, the kind of multiracial, multi-ethnic, pluralistic society that we strive to become. That is the challenge that we're facing right now in the midst of this pandemic. And it's going to be the ultimate guiding question that drives us in 2020 and beyond.
This is Joseph Jackson, host of Cowtown Conversations, and I wanted to tell another one of my stories. I am retired from the Air Force, and I joined our country, and I came, 1998, I came back here to Whiteman Air Force Base in Knobnostra, Missouri. I happened to be here in Lee's Summit visiting some friends in an upscale neighborhood, and I was stopped at a red light, and a police officer was behind me, and as soon as I pulled off, he turned his lights on. I pulled over to the side, and he came up to my car, and he said, "Is this your vehicle?" And I said, "Officer, can you explain why you stopped me?" And he said, "Is this your vehicle?" So he asked twice. I asked the same question twice. He finally said, "Well, is this your vehicle? It's registered to somebody in Knobnostra, Missouri." I guess he didn't know how close Knobnostra was to Lee's Summit. So I said, "Officer, I'm reaching for my billfold." I went to my billfold, pulled out my driver's license. I gave him proof of insurance, vehicle registration, and driver's license. And I said to him, I added one more thing to the top of that, which was my military ID. I said, "You know, we may want to choose our next words carefully because this becomes a federal incident." And I said, "Now, can you explain to me why I was stopped?" Which he still didn't. The job I did was mission critical. So before cell phones fit in the pockets, they came in a bag, and I said, "Officer, hold on, I need to make a phone call." I zipped open the bag, pulled out a phone, and I called my commander. Needed to let him know where I was at, and I told him, I said, "I've been stopped for driving while black in Lee Summit, Missouri." I was really frustrated because I had did nothing wrong at that point in time. And my commander said, "Give the phone to the officer." And he said, "Let me make it clear for you. A, it's his vehicle. B, he's not a drug dealer. Yes, he's in the military. He has a cell phone because we need to know exactly where he's at all times, because there's things that he does that nobody else can do. And if you're going to detain him, we want to know so we can come up tonight and get him out of jail." And he said, "You know, you stopped one of the most educated person in my squadron who's got more degrees." And I had more degrees at that time than my commander, and I was enlisted. I had 4 degrees, and I was doing my doctorate. And the officer's face just lost all color at that point. And so he went back to his car. He put everything into the computer, and he came back just as we told him. And he came back, and he told me, he said, "He stopped me because the light over my taillight was out." And I asked him, I said, "Well, how could you see the light on my taillight was out when your headlights were on the back of my vehicle?" And I said, "That's not what you said to me when you pulled up. You said to me, you asked me, was this my car, because you thought I stole the car." While I could have gotten mad, which I did, it could have turned into a different situation. I just requested for his badge number, the division he worked out of, and his sergeant's name. And I used those things to file a federal complaint. Sometimes the angriest voice is not the voice that we need to hear in a room. Sometimes we need to hear the calmest voice. And when we're going through those type of situations, that calmness, it can be the matter of you walking away with your life or ending up as a statistic. So if you're ever in that situation, definitely think about it, but don't overreact. Get the information that you need so that that encounter with that officer turns out to where you both go home at the end of the day and not one of you goes home in a body bag.
SURGE is a racial justice organization. It stands for standing up for racial justice, or excuse me, showing up for racial justice. It's an organization to organize white people like myself in accountability with black, indigenous, and other people of color in order to fight as a multiracial coalition for racial justice. But we understand as white folks that racism is an invention from us. It's racism is something that we benefit from every day and every moment. So because of that, we feel like it's our responsibility as white folks to organize ourselves and really dismantle the problem that we created and we continue to benefit from and be complicit in. It's essential that we remain accountable to black people and other people of color. And so because of that, for the SURGE structure is to have a people of color power team, in which we're continually kind of checking the decisions that we make and as we work for racial justice, to make sure that they're in alignment and they're in accountability and also in relationship with black people and other people of color. You know, to do that, as you mentioned before, before we were being recorded, one of the things that's really difficult for white people, because part of the power of whiteness and white supremacy is it goes unnamed most of the time. And that gives it a sense of the unnamed normalcy. And that's a lot of its strength. So one of the big things that we try to do with each other as white folks is really unpack that and challenge that and dismantle that. But because very few of us, if any of us, are socialized to raised to do that and understand that, that comes with a lot of mistakes. You know, part of our points of unity and part of our philosophy is to make mistakes and keep going and to continue to call folks into this work, understanding that we're only along a path that we'll never arrive to the end of. So we try to do it with a lot of humility. So SURGE began here in Kansas City after the Ferguson uprising, and also during the presidency of Barack Obama, when folks were noticing a couple things that were happening in white communities. One is the rise of what we think of as the more overt racist white supremacists in response to President Obama's presidency and every decision that he would make. We saw this kind of manifest in the politics of the Tea Party and other things like that. But the other side of it is white progressives like myself wanting to push back, fight back against, you know, the reality of white supremacy in black communities, particularly with the murder of Michael Brown. But because so many of us haven't really looked at and challenged the way that whiteness affects and leaves us with this internal sense of superiority, we were showing up into those black-led activist spaces in really harmful ways that was actually working against the ways that would have been useful and helpful for black activists who know what direction they want to go. And so SURGE, you know, really came into the Kansas City space to call in white people, in particular white activists and white progressives, so that we can show up in solidarity with people of color and in better ways and in closer relationship.
Is the accountability arm that they have asked BIPOC folks who are activists, advocates, people that are walking in alignment with them to be in space with one another. And that is where the BIPOC power team comes into play. We are activists and advocates and surrogates in our own right and have issues that we move forward with for ourselves. And we're an accountability arm for SURGE. And so when it comes to the things that we know that we need to do to dismantle white supremacy culture and dismantle racism as well as the other forms of oppression, we recognize that all of us play into that. As Michael was talking about internalized racial superiority, definitely BIPOC folks have internal racialized inferiority, where if we're not careful when we're moving in relationship with white people, that there's a way in which we will allow them to take over, be the authority figures, and not be able to move for ourselves in one another, and that our mutual purpose even more so than liking each other and loving each other, which we do. Our mutual goal is to dismantle white supremacy and to be anti-racist and move ourselves, our organizations, and our collective to being anti-racist organizations.
I also want to add that I think it's important that as white people make sure that we understand that this journey in anti-racism is a continuum, and that as we're seeking to be allies and accomplices and co-conspirators, we don't rush to name ourselves as an ally, because that sort of gives ourselves permission to quit doing the work. And as we know, this work is ongoing and constant, and it's really up to the folks of color that we're in accountability and relationship with to decide whether we're an ally, an accomplice, a co-conspirator in any given moment.
Okay, now a final story from a Kansas City icon, actor, singer, songwriter, recording artist, Danny Cox.
Bill, you know, my encounter with the police was for my whole life, from the time when they were friends in my neighborhood, you know, just guys walking the streets, knew everybody, we knew them, they were on the same level as we were, and I saw it escalate to the point where they became Gestapo, and especially in the South. And so, you know, a black man in the South in the 60s and the 70s driving a rent-a-car was like just having a, you know, target on your back. And so after being stopped over and over again in these towns, and this is not just the South, I'm talking about in Kansas and New Mexico, everywhere I was traveling doing these concerts. And I just got tired of it, and so I decided I'm going to give these guys a chance to be what they really wanted to be policemen for, and that was to help people. They start off with this concept of wanting to help people, and the system just corrupts them. You know, the whole system, just, everything about it just corrupts them. And the fear of their lives. I mean, these guys are out there. I mean, you know, they don't know who's going to in a car when they walk up to it. They have no idea, so they have to come in, you know, with control, you know, just out of simple fear. And so what I decided to do was, instead of waiting for one of them to stop me and go through all my stuff and, you know, have me out on the side of the road, I would get to a town and I would actually look for a policeman, and I'd flag him down. And I would say to him, hey, you know, I'm in town. I'm doing a concert at the college. The directions are bad. Can you show me how to get there? Next thing you know, we're no longer policemen and black dude with a rent-a-car. He's interested in what I'm doing at the college, the music I'm playing. He, you know, what kind of music is it? You know, hey, can I bring my family? Absolutely, bring your family and your wife and kids. And he said, wait, look, just follow me, and I'll take you there. And that's the way it went.
Thank you for joining us on this very special edition of Radioactive Magazine.